I'm going to pose a question or two, and then I'm going to turn to my colleagues to raise questions as well. I was particularly struck by Alvin Toffler's comment with respect to mass everything, that in essence, mass production, mass communication, mass education is a reflection of a second wave society. The area that, and maybe it's because of a particular economic interest of mine, having to do with the Federal Reserve, in essence, we have a mass money policy for the country. And as we listened to Mr. Kotkin, he was telling us about the regional aspects of our country geographically, as well as the types of production that takes place. How do you see us changing from, in essence, from mass money to a money system that could more truly reflect the needs of given regions of the country?
Well, I'm by no means an expert on finance, but it seems to me one of the things we need to prepare for is a multiplication of types of money. That, in fact, we're going to see different kinds of currencies develop in the United States and elsewhere. Some of them, indeed, may be local or regional. Some of them may be specific to a particular industry. Some forms of scrip. If we look closely at the changes that are being heralded or that are being developed with the digitization process, we're going to see a whole variety of new kinds of currencies, and some for specialized purposes, some for specialized groups. And I think that this is not a fantasy. I think this is going to come upon us. And that the commercialization of the internet, which is many companies are working on very, very intensely right now, will encourage that. So I think our entire concept of money and the role it plays in the economy is going to have to be completely rethought. I do believe that central management, the central banks in general, not just the Federal Reserve, central banks are less and less capable of influencing the foreign exchange markets of the world as we have globalized and liberalized capital. And I think that they will play a less important, those kinds of interventions will play a less and less important role domestically as well.
And a question for Paul Johnson. Several years ago, you wrote a piece that appeared in the Washington Times that, in essence, indicated that capitalism had won, but in essence, there were shortcomings in a capitalist system. There were those who didn't make it under a capitalist system, and there was a need for us to address the either changes in the capitalistic system or the way a government should fill a role to assist those who have failed under a capitalistic system. I wonder if you have any thoughts with respect to that.
I didn't hear that question perfectly, but I think I got the gist of it. And my answer is this. One of the best characteristics of capitalism is that it is self-reforming. It tends to respond to new pressures and to new demands of the market without anyone having to do it, because there are millions of people within the capitalist system who are listening and watching and anxious to make money and therefore anxious to respond to public demand or public criticism or public pressure. So I think in general, the capitalist system can be left to itself to deliver the goods in new and different ways, and what is required really from government is to create a humane framework of legislation in which there can be an input of people's desires as to what sort of society they want, how that society should be ordered, what should be the pains and penalties of that society, what should be the corrective forces for its weaknesses. And once having constructed that legislative framework and amending it from time to time as occasion requires, they should let the capitalist system get on with it and deliver the goods according to the framework in which it exists. Now, the whole art of government, as I see it in modern times, is how to get that balance right, how to get the framework effective enough and humanitarian enough without destroying the essential energetic base of capitalism. That is something which congressmen have to determine and which administrations have to determine. And therein lies the whole art of government.
I'll pose just one more question at this point, and then I will turn to Senator Bingaman. And it has, and I'll pose it to Mr. Kotkin, but whoever wants to respond to it, please feel free to. And again, it goes back to your raising the issue about, you might say, regionalization. And I kind of expand that to think of that the production requirements, a recession, as you said, in California is just coming out. The country or California is just coming out of the recession when it appears that there is a move in the rest of the country towards a recession, probably not a recession. But yet the Federal Reserve is, in fact, operates a money supply based on our entire country, number one. And number two, the other aspect of the Toffler comments, the issue or the question about what do we measure? I mean, we are measuring our economy based on an industrial society. Less than 20% of our GDP now is manufacturing, but yet we focus over and over and over again on the issue of capacity, plant utilization, and yet our entire economic structure has changed. And so I guess the bottom line question is, what do we measure, how do we measure these things, and then after we've measured them, how do we put them into effect? So I know that's a very broad question. Joel, why don't you go ahead and start, and then we'll see if the others want to hop in.
Well, I think that from the experience we had in California, and I was involved in a lot of these debates, what we recognize are several things. The government, whether it's state or federal, is very, very poor at measuring what one might call the new economy. First of all, many times unemployment is, and what's going on in the economy, you look at a certain subset of companies that may not represent where the jobs are being created. So we found, for instance, estimates of job losses from the recession in California were as high as 800,000 to a million. They ended up being closer to 500,000. Now that's nothing to go dancing in the streets about, but you know that's missing a lot. So I think what we have to start doing is looking at trying to find out ways of measuring self-employment more directly, following smaller companies more directly so that we have a better idea of what's actually bubbling up. And then you were mentioning that we measure industrial economy. You know, one of the big problems is that it's very hard to know where manufacturing starts and where service begins, because these things are now so interlocked with each other that it's becoming very, very difficult to understand exactly what's going on. So one of the things that I think we need to do is to start to understand and start to study where the jobs are being created on the local level. And that may tell us much more about what's going on. Now, fortunately, in LA County, the city and AT&T did commission a very excellent study on the structure of the economy. And we found out all sorts of things that nobody suspected. The percentage of minority ownership, who was working in what industry. We found out, for instance, that we said, well, we're losing all these good paying jobs because of defense. Well, because defense has a very big presence, and we knew that they paid relatively well. We found out that most of the sectors that were growing actually paid better, particularly entertainment. So I think we need to look at the economy very differently and also to study what we call services and really go into the various components of services, because there are producer services, there are services that you want to call entertainment a service, some would call it a disservice. But nevertheless, these industries have really not been studied. They've not been looked at. The supplier networks, the way the software industry works. So one of the things I would really encourage the committee to do is to start looking at why we often are so off in our estimates and the new components of the economy, trying to understand how they work, because they're very difficult to measure, but with new technology and study, we found, at least in the AT&T project that was done here in Southern California, that we found very interesting things that I think have now, for instance, been led to, for instance, Mayor Reardon beginning to look at different approaches to economic development. And I think that's what we really need to do, because we've been looking at big units for so long and established industries for so long at a time when we're going to smaller units and more diverse industries. And so we have to start asking different kinds of questions. And I think we're going to need to do a lot more grassroots, county by county, city by city studies and then extrapolate up instead of extrapolating down, taking a look at the big national snapshot and saying, well, this is what's happening in the economy, because it just doesn't measure what's happening.
Very good. Mr. Toffler?
Yes, I'd like to just throw in a few names here. It seems to me that before you can start measuring, you need to know what it is, the question you raise is apropos. What are you going to measure? We need to frame the questions better before we then design the tools. Right now, I believe that in economics, it's fair to say we have we've seen a process of greater and greater precision in the measurement of variables that are less and less important. And I would like to suggest that this committee and other institutions concerned with the development of a third wave economy begin to look at the work of people who are working outside the framework of second wave economics, like Joel, for example. But also, I'd like to just throw some names at the committee. Peter Drucker obviously comes to mind immediately. Kevin Kelly has written a book called Out of Control, about the nature of complexity within the economy. Paul Romer of Stanford is trying to work on the question of how do you measure ideas, the value of ideas in the economy, as I understand it. A man named Orio Giorini in Geneva works on the service economy and risk. Paul Strassman, who was one of the leading information experts in the country, has written several books about the measurement of knowledge and information and productivity in these industries. Kenichi Omai is a brilliant Japanese economist and writer. He used to head the McKinsey office in Tokyo. Jacques Attali, we may disagree with him politically, but this is an extremely imaginative man with many insights into economics that are outside the conventional frame. Hazel Henderson, Eugene Lobel, James Brian Quinn, Edgar Kahn, Ikujiro Nanaka, and Hirotaka Takayuchi, they have a new book on the processes by which in companies and economies get new ideas. What's the creative process that then results in economic return, and so on. And so I think that rather than the usual cast, the usual suspects being rounded up, we need to begin to look at the outriders, the people who have been criticizing from the outside, and whose ideas, not all those ideas are necessarily going to be valuable, but they may give us a fresh way to frame the questions better before we start measuring them. So I'm for opening up and for, as I say, bringing in those who are beginning to work outside the imprisoning framework of second wave economics.
Very good. Senator Bingaman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. You've got a very interesting group of panelists here. Let me just make a brief statement and point to a few charts, and I apologize for not having smaller copies that you could see more easily, but just to indicate the points that they make and then ask your comment on it, Mr. Toffler. You talk about the profound technological change that we are experiencing and have experienced in recent decades, and all of the changes that that's bringing about in our society and our culture and a variety of things. And I agree with you. Much of that profound technological change, it appears to me, has been the result of very substantial federal support for research and development since the Second World War, primarily. And this chart, I think, makes the point that it starts in the period 1961 and goes through the period 2001 and shows the level of federal support for civilian research and development, not defense. We excluded defense-related from this, but shows the level of support as a percentage of gross domestic product. And you can see that at one point we were at 1%. That was at the height of the space program back in the 60s. We are today at right at 0.45% in that range. And under the budgets that we've adopted, both in the House and the Senate, we are headed to be about 0.27% as we end the decade. So I guess my first question is, and also let me point out that, let me show you two other charts very quickly. One of them shows a comparison of U.S. investment in research and development, both public and private. The private is this this orange, and the public is the yellow. And Japanese investment, private and public, and government and German investment the same way. And that's in 1992, and I think the case can be made that the percentage of our gross domestic product going to research and development will be dropping substantially over the next few years, the way we're presently planning. And then the final chart is taken from essentially an article that was in the Wall Street Journal about 3 or 4 weeks ago, where they pointed out that several of our major companies have plans to cut back fairly dramatically on research and development. IBM, General Electric, AT&T, Xerox, Texaco, Kodak, they are all planning substantial cuts in those areas. I guess what I would like your comment on is, and I agree with your point about the need, how we need to demassify and we need to customize solutions, but it strikes me that a driving force in the progress that has been made and in the development of this third wave that you're talking about has been significant federal support for research and development, which we seem in this Congress to be backing off of very dramatically in our budget projections. I would assume that you believe the need for continued substantial levels of federal support for research and development is there, that we've not invented everything we need to invent. Is that a reasonable statement?
Well, I think R&D is clearly one of the driving forces and is extremely important. One of the questions, though, that one needs to ask is, what is the relationship between input and output? That is a really powerful new breakthrough idea something that is a consequence of a certain amount of fixed investment? I don't think that's the case. I think that it's nonlinear, that it's not one-to-one. And I don't know what the appropriate level of R&D expenditure is. In a general sense, of course, we want more focus. And I think that one of the good things about descaling the economy is that companies are getting smaller, more flexible, more quickly adaptable to market changes and so forth. But one of the negatives of that is that small companies frequently don't have a lot of money to do R&D with. So maybe what needs to be done is to facilitate their cooperation. So cooperative research capabilities. The old industrial style laboratory model, Bell Labs, for example, which was fantastic, and some of the federal labs, may be the wrong model for how to go about nowadays creating the kind of research and development output that's required. I certainly am not in favor of sort of a blind blunderbuss butchering of the R&D budget, but I do think we have to think about it differently, and we have to see it in relationship to certain other processes in the society. In fact, we might talk about a knowledge strategy for the country. R&D is part of a larger set of questions that I think will affect the overall economy and the security of this country and of other countries. And that is, what's the relationship between all of the informational or knowledge inputs? R&D is one, education clearly another. Brain drain. What about the folks that are coming to this country, and what do they bring with them in the way of scientific and technological resources? So I would like to see us begin, at least in a very, very vague way, to think about the relationships of all of those, and then to begin talking about the concept of knowledge strategy. Not to do that is what I said before. It's like Saudi Arabia not knowing what to do with oil.
Let me pick up on your point about R&D being one part of this knowledge strategy and education being another part mm-hmm. of it. A concern I've had is that as technology becomes more and more prevalent in our society and the access to it becomes more clearly an advantage, the danger is there that we will, instead of this bringing us together as a society, it will divide us. And in our schools, those students whose parents have bought them Macs or PCs to use at home to hook up to the internet will have such an advantage over those students who do not have that, that we get into a very unequal educational opportunity for students, and that in order to compensate for that, the government needs to either federal, state, local, whoever, someone needs to ensure that technological literacy is taught in the schools, and that students in the schools, regardless of what they have at home, have access to new technologies and have an ability to be familiar with that technology by the time they graduate. Would you agree with that, basically?
I would agree with that, but it may not be only in the schools. The schools themselves are probably America's most backward, most recalcitrant second-wave system. The schools were designed like factories, with kids going into them, being measured going in, sure, being subjected to routine processing while they're there, doing rote and repetitive work, and then being measured when they come out. So our entire education system was a second-wave model that worked very, very well for an industrial smokestack kind of society. So we have to reconceptualize education as well from the ground up. And one of the very interesting processes that happened in the society, which I don't know quite what to make of, but I think we ought to be aware of it. One of the most important forms of learning that took place in the United States in the last 20 years, one of the most profound and economically significant forms of education that took place in this country between, say, 1975 and 1995, was the fact that 20, 30, or 40 million Americans learned to use PCs. That's amazing. That's truly amazing. And the question is, how do they learn? Very few went to school. Mostly, the first ones learned from kids at Radio Shack stores who said, push this button. And then they learned from gurus, computer gurus. The guru was somebody who bought a machine a week before they did. And what you had was a kind of people-to-people process within the society that diffused information and is continuing even now. I think we should be thinking about education and the diffusion of this kind of, particularly this kind of information, not just in the framework of schools. Now, I am deeply concerned about the problem of the information rich and the information poor. My wife and I have been calling attention to that for at least 25 or 30 years, the danger of that kind of a split within the society. But I think we should also be aware of the factors that work in our favor, and that is this. I believe it is in the interest of major commercial organizations, corporations, and others to diffuse the technology as widely as possible. You know, when the telephone was introduced, it was regarded as a super luxury that only the super rich would have. And in Britain, if you had a telephone, you didn't answer it, you sent the butler to answer it because it was beneath your dignity to answer a telephone. Nobody could imagine universal access. Simply impossible to imagine at that time. But in fact, it's in the interests of companies all over. They want to send, they would like to send bills to everybody. They'd like to bombard everybody with their messages and so forth. And I think that there's a big built-in process which will help universalize at least some of the technology. It will not eliminate all inequalities. And the kind of changes that we're talking about, going from a second wave industrial mass economy to a third wave demassified economy, will inevitably be accompanied by massive dislocations, just as the Industrial Revolution was. And we need to think about precisely the kind of question you raised, but think about that hopefully in fresh ways.
Mr. Kotkin, I think you wanted to get in here as well.
I just, there are so many points here that I just wanted to deal with. First of all, on the chart that the Senator gave, there are many countries that have had very even larger percentages of investment than Germany, for instance, industrial R&D. And yet what's interesting is that to try to juxtapose that with what Alvin was just talking about, how the United States ended up becoming the cutting-edge country despite relatively low public investment in R&D in, for instance, the computer revolution, in biotechnology. There are many things that are different about how innovation takes place today than it did 20 or 30 years ago. And I think, yes, the federal role is important, but I think one thing that would be very useful to study would be to study the culture of innovation that takes place, like the Silicon Valley case, the technology innovation that takes place among collaborative networks. And there's a group of other people who keep getting names thrown at you, but I think Charles Sable, Michael Priori, David Friedman, all who come out of MIT, who have studied these clusters of industries which very often get almost no government support and yet are very, very innovative. And again, the entertainment industry, which I'm quite familiar with, works very much on this kind of model. And I think we have to begin to look at not is R&D and is innovation important, it's more important than ever, but how do we get there? And I think a way to do that may be to study it. We do know that many governments, for instance, like France, which used enormous amounts of money to push innovation through government process, did not work. And France is not the technological leader of the world in many areas. It's usually either the United States or Japan in most cases. So I think we really just have to think about it in a very, very different way. We have to look at these cooperative models. And I think that's also particularly true of the schools and education. And what I find happening, at least in cities that I go to, is more and more parents beginning to get together and volunteer groups getting together to begin to push this process. I was at a meeting with Black data processing executives, and they have already started a series of little computer schools in historically Black churches to teach kids after school. I think that the whole idea of, you know, as we move away from a 9-to-5 workplace, we may also be moving away from a 9-to-5 school place. And I know this, I've got a 5-month-old daughter, I think about her education in a very different way than my parents thought about my education. So I think that we need to look very much at the issues that are important that the Senator laid out, to think about them differently, because the solutions are going to be different, and we really need to look at how innovation now takes place on a very crowded stage through interaction between individuals of common interest.
Thank you very much, Senator Grams.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and I want to thank our panel members for joining us today, hearing on technology, using such technology to get it done, and I want to welcome you all here. First, I just wanted to mention briefly, and I want to address my first question to Mr. Toffler, that basically this third wave economy is going ahead with or without the government. I mean, it is moving in that direction. So what I think we would like to really get a handle on is what is the government's role as we move into the next century, and should the government role be one of trying to drive this technology, or one to dictate this technology, or should the government really be out there trying to provide an environment for the private sector to do what it can do best?
Well, I don't believe that there is a 100% answer to that question, because nothing's 100%. But in general, this thing is happening. And the Industrial Revolution didn't primarily happen because the British government said it should happen. It happened because of some very strange people located frequently in provincial towns made it happen. There's a wonderful brief story. Between 1640 and 1805, approximately, a group of men met one night a month, the night of the full moon, in Birmingham. And their neighbors called them lunartics, because of the moon. And the Royal Society in London said these were rubes and hicks. What did they know about anything? And for 40 years they met. They never took minutes. They never wrote a resolution. They never did anything formal. But who were they? They were Priestley, Galton, Erasmus Darwin, and when he was in Britain, Benjamin Franklin. These were the authors of the Industrial Revolution, if you could say that. So the government didn't have a lot to do with it. This is bigger than governments, and the third wave is bigger than governments. And I think that that doesn't mean that government has nothing to do. There are certain rules that need to be imposed, and there are certain limits, beyond which we do not go. We do not believe in slavery. We do not permit slavery. That's a moral injunction that the government essentially supports. We have a set of values as Americans. We have a belief in human rights. Those things we have to support. There are other things that we can do, as Joel was saying a moment ago, to encourage the climate, encourage venture capital, encourage entrepreneurialism. But the old centralist model that we used to hear a lot about, that the United States ought to create the equivalent of the Japanese Ministry of International Trade and Industry, MITI, that model is no longer the appropriate model. It's not even appropriate in Japan.
Mr. Kotkin, I'd like to follow up on that by asking you a question. You had said somewhere in your testimony that this new third wave, diverse economy, is really basically hostile to Washington. Washington's, I think what you meant, it's one-size-fits-all type policy, and I believe in many respects Washington hinders productivity in many respects. So, but what did you mean by the third wave diversity and moving of economy that is more regional than national and is hostile to Washington?
Well, it's hostile in part because I think it presents the idea that there is a single solution to any problem. Whether it's on an industry basis or a regional basis, the problems in the different parts of the country are very, very different. What might work in Iowa doesn't work in Washington State. And the idea that somebody sitting in Washington is going to determine what's happening. I mean, for instance, I don't mean to do this in a partisan way, but you know, when you had, for instance, President Clinton at the State of the Union, had John Scully there, and Washington going around saying, "Well, Silicon Valley is lined up behind Clinton." Well, John Scully was outside of the Silicon Valley. He was not really part of the Silicon Valley world, and he was an outsider brought in. And yet, Washington doesn't understand the complexities of this. And also, what you have in whether you're in Silicon Valley or Austin, Texas, or North Carolina, or in South Florida, or wherever, where there is a growing industry of collaborative networks beginning to develop, is that the people involved are too busy to get involved in Washington. And they almost immediately feel that any attempt by government to regulate them or even to help them is viewed with some hostility because they don't have the time to interface. But they know the big aerospace companies, the large unions, the major financial institutions have their lobbies and are going to be there. And these are people who just want to get it done. They are really like the people that Alvin was talking about in Birmingham. They're doers. They're people who want to do things. And they see Washington as sort of playing a game or not understanding them. So I think that that's what the hostility is all about. And I think that there was really a strong need on the part of Washington to understand the psychology. And I think with this new technology, you have an opportunity. You're going to listen to someone like Brenda French later on, and she will be able to tell you how an actual business in this world actually works. And I think that there's a big problem when you have people, whether they're classic market economists on one side or more interventionist-minded economists on the other side, who both of whom are equally divorced from the reality of the new economy. And therefore, they feel a hostility towards the whole system. They may be a prejudice towards the free market economists only because they'll be more likely to leave them alone.
So you're saying that all good information doesn't come out of Washington?
I think most of the good information. Occasionally there are good articles in the Washington Post, but I think that the diffusion of information technology and knowledge, which is more important, around the country is very, very profound and something that really we haven't begun to deal with. And that the idea that Washington is the measure of all things, that that's where somebody who's even interested in government wants to go, we now find very often very, very bright, committed, intelligent policymakers in Salt Lake City, even occasionally in Sacramento. And so I think that we need to think very, very differently about information, knowing that there are now many people who don't regard getting to the apex of the government, which is Washington, or the apex of a large corporation, as what they want to do with their lives, and yet they can still be very innovative and creative people.
Thank you very much. And I have just one brief question for Mr. Johnson in London. I couldn't pass up the opportunity to ask, but briefly, you mentioned your concern, your number one concern for the United States was our indebtedness. And I can tell you that's a major concern of this government today because of our efforts to try to balance our budget by the year 2002. But, Mr. Johnson, is your concern for the U.S. similar to your concerns for the rest of the world, Europe, Asia, and other countries? Or do you feel that we have been more lax in getting our house in order and better pay more attention to it?
I think the United States, because of its size and its history and its principles, ought to set a good example to the rest of the world. That may seem rather hard for you people to bear, but I think it's true. People do look to the United States for an example. If the United States were to get its budget into balance and set about reducing its huge national debt, I think this would help those finance ministers throughout the world who are struggling with spendthrift congresses and parliaments and so forth to say, look, the United States is doing it, it's the richest country in the world, we must follow suit. So I think it's a question of morality, it's a question of good examples. And that leads me to another point, which is relevant to the question of R&D. I don't have a great deal of sympathy with comparative R&D figures, because I can remember when for years and years we were told in Britain that our R&D spending was so low. Look at the Soviet Union, their R&D spending was enormously high, and that was why it was going to overtake the rest of the world, etc. So I don't believe terribly in those figures. What I do believe is in freedom in which men and women can exercise their capabilities. During the 17th and 18th centuries, Britain benefited from a huge input of scientists and writers and experts and craftsmen of all kinds from the continent of Europe, because we were a free society and their societies weren't, and they brought with them their brains and their expertise and their ideas and their imaginations. I think the United States, from its very inception in the early 17th century, has benefited from the same process. Now, we saw this at work in the 1930s, where Germany was an unfree society, Britain and the United States were free societies, and we took perhaps the best 10% of their scientists and inventors and experts in all fields, because they were immigrants, they wanted to go to a free society. It is of the essence of someone with an outstanding intellect and a creative intelligence to want to work in a free society. So I think insofar as the American government is concerned with R&D, it ought to have as its first priority ensuring that America remains free, and particularly free on the university campus, because that is what matters in terms of getting immigrant scientists and experts in all fields. And therefore it should take a hostile view to any threats to that freedom, such as political correctness. That is much talked about in Europe today, and I think it does deter Europeans from wanting to go to American campuses because they feel they won't be free enough. So I think the first concern of the American administration, of the American Congress, ought to be to maintain America's traditions of academic and other freedoms at the very highest pitch. Then I think you will get the people you need, and you will get the R&D you need.
Thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. Thank you.
Senator Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm boggled at the intellectual candle power that we have in front of us, and I'd like to spend the whole day in dialogue, and that would drive everybody off the television, shut down the committee and all the rest of it. Let me make a few quick comments. Mr. Toffler, you talked about different kinds of cash. I have one in my hand.
Right.
And interestingly, it says the value of this card, this for those out in television land that don't recognize it, this is a fare card for the Washington Metro. You cannot get on the Metro with cash. You have to buy a new kind of currency,
right,
which is electronic. I paid $20 for this card. It says that its value is $22. In other words, I got a 10% return on my money instantly. Put that into an annual compounding and tell you what the value of this card is in terms of my investments in municipal bonds or anything else. If I can get a 10% return in less than a second, this is a pretty good deal. Now, the flip side of it, of course, is that I have to spend it on the Metro. I cannot use it with that 10% return to buy a house or a new pair of socks or anything else. But no bank issued this money.
Right.
This is very real money. And also, if I lose the card, I can't call somebody up and say, I lost your check, will you issue a new one?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's a degree of risk connected with it. I think that summarizes what it is you're talking about in a way.
Exactly.
There is a very focused use. It is new cash of a new kind, and it has a different set of risks connected with it, one of which, if we get into the whole world of electronic cash, has to do with forgery and money laundering and all of the difficulties. I come from a state that Mr. Kotkin keeps referring to, and I'm grateful to him for the plug. We are trying to rival Silicon Valley as the center of software activity, indeed in terms of number of companies, not number of amount of business, but number of companies. There are more software companies in Utah than there are in Silicon Valley. And of course, the two primary ones that everybody's heard about are WordPerfect and Novell, who have now merged. But around those two giant planets, a whole host of satellites have sprung up, and this whole issue of electronic currency is one of intense interest in my part of the country. Could you say, for example, and this is piggybacking on what the chairman said, do you have any ideas as to what the role of the central bank, for example, is going to be in a world of in my wallet, instead of my carrying a bunch of pictures of dead presidents, I carry a bunch of brown magnetic strips.
On one side, one can imagine a kind of total surveillance system in which all electronic transactions are tracked and registered, and therefore Uncle Sam becomes Big Brother. But on the other side, I think it's going to be extremely difficult to do that. I think every time the government tries to manage that money system, there are going to be new outbreaks, new forms, new growths, to use a more biological analogy, and that in fact the concept of money itself is going to be quite different for our kids than it is for us. And I have just for an amusing comment. I made this speech in Moscow a few years ago to a meeting of economists and social scientists, and I said, to illustrate the point, I held up a dollar and I said, see, this is not money, and I took out a credit card and I said, this is real money, and they said, yes, but there's a third kind, the ruble, no money. In a second wave economy, most work is interchangeable. I worked for 5 years in American factories in the Midwest. I worked on the auto assembly line. I worked as a millwright in a steel foundry for a few years. I turned out many different kinds of products with my hands. And if I dropped dead on the job, I could be replaced in about 2 minutes flat, because there was no skill content to that job, nor was it particularly based on teamwork. Today, that's different. In a third wave economy, labor becomes less and less interchangeable. Now, what are the consequences of that? We have large numbers of people who do not have the appropriate skills for the marketplace and who are therefore left behind by these changes. In the second wave economy, we learned from the monetarists and from Keynes that you could manipulate the macroeconomy, you could stimulate it, and if you had a million people unemployed, you could, by playing those games, stimulate the economy, create a million jobs, and then these people would take those jobs. In a third wave economy, however, if you have a million people unemployed, you can play all the games you want with a macroeconomy. You can stimulate the economy. You can use Keynesian measures or monetarist measures, tax measures, so forth and so on. And you can succeed and create 10 million jobs. These million people can't do those 10 million jobs. Therefore, unemployment has gone from quantitative to qualitative. It is a matter of matching skills, and not just technical skills, but even cultural skills, to the appropriate requirements. Now, what are the solutions that we're being offered or being discussed? The Clinton administration, to its credit, talks about the need for training and retraining, and I'm in favor of that. However, The problem is, how do you do that? How do you, in fact, provide at least the access to upskilling large numbers of Americans? The problem is, you've got to take another feature of this new economy into account, and that is innovation and acceleration. By the time you've got somebody trained, the skill sets required may also have changed. So you're shooting at a moving target. And that is why I believe the problem of unemployment is going to be extremely difficult and structural. And it isn't just poor people and ghetto people who are going to suffer it. Large numbers of middle-class people who have skills but in the wrong place at the wrong time are also going to undergo periods of unemployment. And I think this means that there will be a fundamental change in the politics of unemployment, because unemployment is not just going to be something that happens to them, it's also going to be something that happens to us. And therefore, the entire politics will change. As to how to think about the retraining process, it is very difficult, but I believe that there is a model that is that as between two models that are being discussed, there is one that is superior. One model that's being discussed, which is essentially turning the problem of training over to the states. And in general, I favor turning more and more federal functions over to the states or to the regions. However, there is a better model, and we did it before, and it's called the GI Bill of Rights. The GI Bill of Rights was, in my judgment, perhaps the best piece of social legislation passed by this country in the last half century. And what that did was essentially voucherize individuals, rather than turn the question of what should I study and what are appropriate subjects and how do we match the skills to the requirements, instead of those decisions being made centrally, those decisions should and can be made by individuals in pursuit of their own and being aware of their own skills, talents, energy levels, brain power, etc. So that I strongly favor essentially the voucherization of training as at least a very partial step toward dealing with these dislocations.